and welcome. Nice of you to stop by. I hope you're doing great today. This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. My name is Henrik Palmgren. I am your host. This program is dedicated to finding the truth and exposing hidden and not-so-hidden agendas. How history is being used against us, the war on human nature, and the details of the geopolitical chessboard and the roots of subversive political movements. We also cover a lot of other subjects, everything really that is related to the bigger picture of our place in the world, our purpose, and of course solving the riddles of our unknown past. Today we're talking with Thomas Sheridan, who's back on the program. He's an artist, author, musician, satirist, and independent researcher, probably best known for the book Puzzling People, The Labyrinth of the Psychopath, along with his writings on socio-cultural engineering, propaganda, and the influence of late Victorian occult societies and policy think tanks upon the creation of both fascism and Bolshevism. Thomas' latest book that we'll also discuss today is called Valpurgis Night, Volume 1, a book that initially started out as an occult history of National Socialism and the Abrahamic destruction of indigenous European wisdom and archetypes in tandem with the influence of the British Israelite movement. However, Sheridan soon realized that he was writing a history of our contemporary era within the framework of Germany between the two world wars. This is a very enlightening discussion on cultural Marxism, our skewed history, and what we need to do to become a force of resistance. Stick around. And welcome back, Thomas. Great to talk with you again. How have you been? It's been a few months since we last talked, and was such a good show last time, so it's great to have you back.
Yeah, and it's great to be back so soon. I really enjoyed the last talk, and I got a great reception for me personally. And it's always a pleasure to come back on Red Ice, so thanks for asking me back, Henrik.
You bet, Thomas. Thank you. Now, it was a lot of people, I think, have actually opened their eyes after what we talked about last time and some of the consequent articles and actually realized how they're being duped. And this is something we're going to tie into a little bit more later here and talk more about what actually happened. Some of the follow-up, basically, of what has happened with the brand story and everything else. But I've really been enjoying some of your articles lately and some of your posts as well. A resolute charged against cultural Marxism and its corrosive and destructive effect on our societies and on our psyche and everything else. When did you get on this page, Thomas? And we talked about that last time. Obviously, you've been aware of this for a long time, but it seems like you've been even more firm in your direction lately. So tell us about that.
When I realized that I had been duped when I was younger, and for most of my life, I used to always think of myself as a liberal, basically out of human decency. I just wanted a better world for everyone. And I fell under that spell of being sucked into that kind of liberal progressive thing for many, many years, believing that that was the good guy. And, a long time ago, I broke that spell, but in the last few months, specifically in relation to some of the things that have been going on here in Ireland, I've become very angry about it. I've become very angry about the fact that I was duped into believing that, emigration was just helping people from other countries. I'm very, and I sincerely used to believe that. I've come to the conclusion now, what it is it's basically a population removal and replacement, agenda by the European Union. Yep. To kill, national identity in all the EU states. Peter Sutherland, my old boss at Goldman Sachs, head of the World Bank, Bilderberg's AIB, an unbelievable, monstrous globalist, even said in the BBC last year that the purpose of emigration should be used to destroy national identity in the EU because EU harmonization isn't moving fast enough for his tastes. So it was basically that trigger did it for me. Plus the idea that it's very easy to put a person in a corner and call them a racist and so on and have them defend their humanity before they can get to the point that they're actually making. And I see more and more that although these people call themselves progressives and liberals, there is an inherent viciousness, that's the word I would use, mm-hmm. viciousness, that's right up there with the worst elements of National Socialism or Bolshevism. In fact, it probably comes out of both elements of that uses the same tactics, but in the way that the Frankfurt School you know, called it, or the Fabians, who were actually the inspiration for the Frankfurt School, they called the honeycomb effect, or permeation, the idea of just changing language in order to screw people up, was essentially a kind of like a linguistic magic at the end of the day, black magic. And it annoyed me. And also in the last 2 years, and especially in the last 6 months, I've got very heavily into researching the history of Germany at the end of the World War One and the beginning of the Weimar Republic. And I saw the seeds of this mess that we're in now, and how the soul of Europe, which would have been Germany when you think about it, was being used as a kind of a globalist chessboard from everybody, from the British Israelites, the Fabians, mm-hmm. the Frankfurt School, the National Socialists, the Bolsheviks. They were all doing it. And there was no, it was almost like a gigantic experimentation laboratory. And the seeds of that were so powerful and so toxic that they not only destroyed Europe in World War II, but they're still, the World War II has never ended. No. It just went to the psyche. It just went from the war of Europe to the psyche of Europe. And it's raging in there. And I, you know, I wouldn't say I felt victimized, but I certainly felt that I had been duped, and I resented the fact that I was duped. And I was going to turn around, you know, my job now is just trying to turn around and tell people, look, don't fall into the trap I did. You can be critical of certain policies that may relate to racial or religious ideas, and even atheistic or anything ideas, and not have to defend your humanity to get there.
Right. Yeah.
Your human decency is inherent, and it's a separate thing from that.
Yeah, it's an important point. I mean, once you begin to kind of read what some of the people have said as well, when it comes to specifically Europe, but really the Western world. I mean, if we look at the, you know, the Frankfurt School and everything else, but you mentioned Peter Sutherland, another high profile one that another guest told me about here recently, Wesley Clark, the, you know, American former NATO general. And let's listen to this quote. He said, "Let's not forget what the origin of the problem is. There is no place in modern Europe for ethnically pure states. That's a 19th century idea, and we are going to transition into the 21st century, and we are going to do it with multi-ethnic states." Like, why is a NATO general from America getting involved in this kind of stuff? What is the war really on here? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Again, it's the mind. It's the psyche. It's to get into the psyche. The war... you know, I've been saying for a long time, I think I said it on the first interview I ever did in Red Ice a couple of years ago, that if there's such a thing as a battle of Armageddon, it's taking place in the field of human consciousness.
Yeah.
And that's where they've been fighting. They've been fighting there for a long time. Now, in a regular war, in a normal conflict, you're aware of the rules of engagement. The rules of engagement are that the enemy declare war upon you, they make an attack, and then that's it. But when we're dealing with the likes of the Frankfurt School, the cultural Marxist, they do not tell us, they do not inform us that they're at a state of war with us, both as, you know, Western nations and Western individuals. And it's not just a racial or religious or an ethnic thing. They want the whole world this way. They're reconstructing Africa. They're reconstructing South America. They're reconstructing, you know, India. Anyone who's watched Indian movies like I have in the last 20 years can see how they've literally rebuilt that society from the bottom up using, you know, Hollywood style infiltration of their movie industry. And this is how it is. And when you see how clear it is, you're amazed that you never noticed it before.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's what I always find amazing. It's like, yeah. I think like at this stage in my life, I've seen everything. But then you see something and it's like, how did I miss that? And it's because it's a covert, clandestine underground war against our consciousness by very powerful people with enormous financial and public resources. And this is why it takes us by surprise. They are basically saboteurs operating behind what they see are enemy lines.
Certainly. I mean, the revival of cultural Marxism within the mainstream is obviously going kind of beyond the whole climate issue and climate change movement and you know, everything that was going on with the global warming. I mean, we could see how the leftists co-opted the green movement. I mean, this is kind of really a trait of what they do, though. They latch onto any minority, any kind of sappy story that they can to try to gain this, points basically for people, so that they realize this is a way to disarm them. You speak to their morality. You speak to them, they're most people are naive, unfortunately, so they kind of tend to fall for these issues. But cultural Marxism is something that's really kind of expanded in the last, I don't know, say 5 to 10 years into all these different fields, and it's just beginning to like take over everything. What would you say about that, Thomas?
Well, they scored a phenomenal victory with the global warming and the climate change thing, because again, anything that's good or decent and is born out of human decency, and also the right to, you know, the ecology movement of modern times really spawned out of what happened at Chernobyl. That's when it really started taking off. That's when I became interested, and many people became interested in the idea of the damage that could be done to the planet by human technology if it's not properly taken care of, without being a Luddite. And they so successfully infiltrated that. I saw it with my own eyes with the Ecology Party here in Ireland. They, you know, suddenly one minute it's about, you know, going down to some factory that's, you know, dropping heavy metals into a river, and the next thing it's about, you know, gay and lesbian issues, and out of the blue.
Yeah.
And this is what happened. They swing everything into it. If you go into any of their approved climate change sites, it's everything from social policy to economic policy to things that you wonder how they're, you know, the climate change, how does that impact on rapes, you know, articles run by feminists. They're very good at this. They're very good at seeping in and you know, attaching and coupling their whole agenda to anything that appeals to decent people. But they do it through emotions, and this is what's very psychopathic about it, because they play on, you said, sappiness, and you know, they'll do it in such a way that it'll get people to be worried about something or concerned out of their own human decency. But that's very psychopathic how they do that. They're just basically making a sucker of people, and they enjoy it. You can see they enjoy it, and it's so scientific. Like we spoke in the last interview, they so scientifically analyze, process the data, and then work upon that in order to create change. It's the only way they can really do it, because if they were to do it overtly, now they did it. To be honest, they did kind of. At the same time, they played a blinder and got so much of their policy through with the climate change issue. They also did their usual old mistake that so many Bolsheviks do, and that they tended to rush too fast into it to the point where there was a big backlash against their so-called, you know, Al Gore science and so on.
Yeah.
And that's so they're always they're very clever, and they're very devious, but on very major levels, they lack wisdom.
Yeah, I mean, they try to play it as a moral issue, but in reality, it is not. I hope we can kind of also actually get to some of those issues later on in terms of how it's a very difficult thing to describe for people. But the fact is, when people are solely played on their emotions and their naivety, they are very easily, you know, and quickly circling the drain. There has to be a balance here where you appeal to your rationality, thinking about, you know, is this good? I mean, there is such an issue of basically shutting down the engine of civilization just for the sake of saving something. But then in the fact, I mean, it's like saying the same thing, teach a man to, you know, give him a fish and so he'll feed himself for a day, or teach him how to fish so that he can feed himself for a lifetime. It's kind of in that same style. But I'll bring up some more of that later on, ask you some more about that. But I wanted to ask you about the real environmental issues though, because in many cases, the climate change, the global warming movement and everything seems to kind of avoid some of the big keys here. Like obviously you don't hear too much on the GMO issue. What about the poisoning of mankind with petrochemicals and how this is altering us with, you know, phthalates and BPA and everything else? It's like, no, for mankind, you can have recycled, you know, polyester and plastics as your material. That's fine. What I found is it's actually a very anti-human agenda. It's basically mankind is a virus, you're a poison, and the fewer of you there is, the better. That's what I find the reality of the climate change movement coming out. And how is that a moral cause? How is that a just and a righteous you know, approach to what's going on here, right?
Yeah. Michael Coren, he was an author who wrote a very good biography of H.G. Wells. The book is called The Life and Liberties of H.G. Wells, The Invisible Man. And he shows how Wells was a vicious individual. There's just no getting around it. Driven by a deep-rooted hatred of anyone who basically wasn't an aristocratic British Protestant. he was very uncomfortable around normal people. And that becomes apparent by his essays and his articles. And he was obsessed with removing humans from the earth, what he called the base. These were the people who were sort of not fit to exist on this planet, according to his own personal prejudices and, you know, his own beliefs in life. And he used to write these stories in the same kind of way that climate change people do. There was a moral tale about them, like the time machine. You know, there was this moral kind of thing, like it's the only way we can stop war, and if we don't follow this path, and all these kinds of things. And Things to Come was also in the same vein. The idea that he was going, you know, what was going to happen in the future in Britain. And all done in this kind of like, we'll do it for peace and justice and science and all this kind of, and an appealing on a moral basis to you know, the actual the viewer or the reader or to the movie, the cinema goer. And behind all that, H.G. Wells was, you get this impression from the Corran biography, that H.G. Wells had a pathological hatred of human beings, other than anyone he didn't personally approve of, very, very much like a cult leader. And you see how that mentality has been reflected in everything from the Fabians, the Frankfurt School, to Amnesty International, to the climate change things. The same thing. The humans are a virus on this earth, right? But the most dangerous virus of all is Western man. And that's where it really comes down to.
Yeah.
And that's racism, no matter how you look at it. That's racism. You cannot have it, you know, both ways, where you can say that, like, racism against white people is fine, racism against people who are non-whites is evil. You can't have it both ways. It automatically takes white humans, Western humans, and dehumanize them out of the new moral framework. And this very much ties in with that kind of thinking.
Yeah.
And when they talk about humans being a pestilence on the earth, what they're really talking about is people in Western countries. That's really what they're saying.
Yeah, progress is evil. You know, all the things that, of course, many of the other countries in the world now are aspiring to is something that we can't. I mean, I've always seen it as a way to actually shut down the processes of breaking yourselves, you know, out of the system of control and to a certain extent liberating yourself. That's what the war is on. They don't want to have free, you know, thinking, rational human beings. They want to have them either, you know, superstitious or run by some control grid or some system. And actually that whole ideology in itself is very racist, because it, to me, it shows that, okay, the contempt for Western man is based out of the fact that it's probably one that is less easy to control. And therefore, if we can just get rid of that obstacle, everyone else is someone we can basically just kind of we can control them in the manner that we seek. Meaning that that very ideology is a racist ideology to that extent. It's about making those value judgment on everyone else. On the other hand, though, we might have a situation where they might have turned their eyes on Western man for now, but that might be temporarily, and they might actually shift their focus on whoever else stands in the way of their goals next. So that remains to be seen, I guess, if they are to achieve their goals of destroying the West and Western man, you know.
Oh, they will move on someone else if they did do that, which they won't. They will fail. I mean, there's an inherent failure built into their model, which they are unaware of themselves. But they will fail. But they have a history of transferring this enemy from one to the next. So if it ever happened, which it won't, that they completely obliterated Western society, well, then they would target Africa. I have no doubt about that. They've already shown their intent down there with the people like Bill Gates and so on.
Yeah.
You know, I could only imagine what the you know, the pillow talk between Bill Gates and his wife is at the end of the night. You know, honey, how many Africans did we kill today? You know, that's literally what they're doing. And yet no one calls Bill Gates a racist.
He's,
I don't see
he's
Bill
noble,
Gates anywhere
you know?
Else in the world for, you know, whip, you know, running birth control programs other than in Africa. So it, you know, and if he does, he doesn't give it the same attention he does to give to Africa. And it's no different than when you had like Planned Parenthood and the Eugenic Society and all these other aristocrats back in the day doing exactly the same thing. Now, this is a, you see, you had John Rappaport on a few weeks ago, and he had a, that was a phenomenal interview, by the way.
He
said something that was bang on, and it was like one of those things that I literally jumped and punched the air when he said it. He said that a lot of, like Gates and a lot of these types, they're techie nerds, essentially, who see anything that they don't understand in the same way as a computer virus. There's something wrong with the code. There's something wrong with the code. And so the code has to be, you know, we need an antivirus program. So Bill Gates runs an anti-African program, you know, this kind of thing. This is how so many of them think. This is like what Charlie Chaplin said in the Great Dictator movie, robot minds, robot men with robot minds. And that's what we have. So it's not necessarily, you know, always sort of pathologically evil in what they're doing.
Sure.
A lot of the time are just these, like, these dickheads who don't know what a full human existence is, because they've, you know, all they've ever done is sat in front of the computers and looked at strings of code and then transferred that to reality.
Yeah. Efficiency. You have to run it in a certain way, do the algorithms, and then, you know, defrag the program. But it is a program, though. And I think a lot of this has been swallowed, partially at least, because we have such tremendous effect on popular culture coming from this same environment, either if we talk about cultural Marxism or, you know, the Fabians or the Frankfurt School, what have you. The reconstruction of, you know, the art world, and this, of course, taps into the movie industry, Hollywood, and everything else. There's been a, I wouldn't say maybe hijacking of Hollywood. It's been, you know, it was created as for the purposes that it was way back when, but the fact is that this virus have completely taken over everything, and it's almost wherever you look in the art world, whether it's, you know, music or movies or paintings or what have you, it's the same mentality that's behind it. And the few times you get someone who differs from the narrative in that regard, then they are absolutely completely ostracized and hanged out to dry in the media, usually anyway, if they're detected, that is.
Yeah. And then, you know, and it's amazing that that's been going on for years, that they talk about freedom of speech. I can remember, like, at the time, back in the, I think it was the early 90s, you had them starting putting these parental warning stickers on LPs in America, say there was had explicit lyrics and so on. And you had, like, these sanctimonious, like, idiots, like Eric Bogosian, the actor, reading on the MTV Awards, reading the proclamation of the United States and the Bill of Rights, and this music playing, and how he supports his friends, Two Live Crew, you know. And these guys were the lyrics were just basically, you know, they were just basically pornography put into rap music, but they were deliberately done. They were kind of, you know, they weren't done in a funny way. You see, they weren't done like humor. They were done in such a way that they were just meant to be just raunchy. And there's no humorous sideline to it. It wasn't being used in such a way to have an ironic effect. It was just straightforward, you know, in your face smut. End of story. But that they defend that, but they don't defend humor. I mean, cutting humor that might actually bring them down. That's another one that's very interesting for me. They're very selective in what they call freedom of speech, and they're very selective in what they portray. If you look at, you know, okay, here's one thing. I was talking to someone, I may have seen this on Facebook, and it was a point I made about Stephen Fry. Someone put up a meme by Stephen Fry, the British actor, celebrity guy, and it said something along the lines of, people should not be offended. If you take offense, you know, tough shit, that's your problem. And the hypocrisy was nauseating, because Stephen Fry, along with Ben Elton, who was a comic writer and a comedian, very bad one, I might add, in the 1980s, were instrumental in putting down and wiping out really funny British comedians such as Bernard Manning, and they destroyed Benny Hill's career as well, on the idea that they were offensive, they were sexist, they were offensive. Oh, yeah. And these guys made millions on this, and here they are 25 years later saying, if you're offended, tough shit. And then people have very short memories, very short memories of these how sanctimonious these celebrities can be. And Hollywood is there's a book called The Collaboration, Hollywood's Pact with the Nazis, by a guy called Ben Urwand, and he picked up old documentation that showed that the Hollywood movie companies were absolutely enamored by the propaganda of the Third Reich, particularly in their movies, how they were able to socially and culturally change Germans through cinema. People don't know that the German cinema was the biggest one in the world.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. Exactly. They were the masters.
Even though the Nazis had thrived, it was even bigger under the Nazis. And he showed that MGM, who was a company run by Jewish people, was having selective screenings for Nazis in the German consulate in LA to see if their films were developing the same methods of social control that the German cinema, the UAE cinema outside film, it was the Hollywood of Germany outside Berlin, had done to the Germans. The MGM guys didn't care about the Nuremberg racial laws. They didn't care about the treatment of the Jews in Germany. They were simply enamored by the Nazis and the German film industry's ability to control people. And then as soon as World War II starts, what did the Germans, the Hollywood do? Make movies about how evil the Germans are. Oh, it's just like short-term memory idea that, oh, it doesn't matter what happened last year. We're not accountable. The new version of us is accountable.
Well, I mean, it's very interesting how this has played out, and the fact that I see how much has been piggybacked, on each other in that regard, but also the fact that we have, by the time that Hollywood really starts up and everything, I mean, they've done a number on, who was it, Edison, basically, and a lot of their talents, just as you say, were actually ripped off, and not much at all what they did was original, you know. And the Germans were masters at film, and I mean, they were running the whole show in the early days. And then all of a sudden, of course, they basically hijacked everything, took it, and brought it over to Hollywood, and then used the same mechanics. And I think it was the same actually equally with Stalin. I think he was also absolutely enamored by the fact that how well you could manipulate people with film and everything else. So this was basically all the people who wanted to control other people, all the ones who wanted to dictate and change the psyche of the folk, you know, they adopted this technique, and it's something that has been carried on and forward into our days today, you know.
Yeah, when Hitchcock went to Hollywood for the first time, he made some jokey remarks saying that he'd heard so many German accents around him and so many people speaking German, he thought he was in Berlin. And he wasn't joking. So many of them had moved over before the Nazis even came into power, before Fritz Lang had moved over. They had already started trickling over to Hollywood. Someone and something in Hollywood knew that Hollywood was going to be the next big center of, you know, mind control. Long before, you know, I'm talking about long before even, you know, 1919, they knew this, and they were starting to trickle over. Big shot directors, writers, filmmakers, cinematographers were trickling from Germany over to Hollywood in order to take up jobs there. It's almost like it was the first Operation Paperclip. It was almost like they were first bringing them over.
Yeah.
And you can see how they were intoxicated by German cinema. The earliest, you know, Oscars, so many of the awards were given to Germans and German filmmakers. And not just, you know, like the big names like Leni Riefenstahl and Fritz Lang. There was lots of others. The German cinema was very attuned in the production process of a film in terms of cinematography. They invented these ideas of close-ups at certain points, shadows lit from certain areas that give Nar very good at targeting the subconscious. The film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari from 1919, is a masterpiece of that. Even though it's essentially a horror story, it's giving you an underlying, you know, narrative, to use Russell Brand's favorite word, on how to think. And you see that's happening so much in early Hollywood films. We're watching and observing in a very scientific way how they could adopt the techniques of German cinema for social control and use it themselves. And the only way they could have done that, there must have been some kind of serious money or some kind of government money within Hollywood that started trickling all these German cinema geniuses, a lot of them were too, by the way, over to Hollywood. And that was because someone somewhere in the United States probably something to do with the new school in New York, which was the Frankfurt School, basically transferred over, to get them over to Hollywood, to get them altering Americans.
Yeah, it's a very interesting piece of history here. I wonder also how many of those were German Jews, of course, because as we know, I mean, this is just a fact. People can just look it up. I mean, six of the major studios, the heads at the time. I mean, Neil Gabler covered this in his book, An Empire of Their Own, How Jews Invented Hollywood. It's not a big secret. I mean, this is just how it is, people. And if you have some issue with that, just look it up and you'll see that it's a fact. I mean, Lemmel from Universal, Fox from 20th Century Fox, Goldwyn from MGM, Warner from the Warner Bros., Meyer from MGM as well, and Zukor from Paramount. They were all, you know, getting started at this early age and back in the, you know, 20s and 30s and whatnot. And I don't know. It's at a certain point here, of course, we get a switch over, but the first, when we see the rise of the industry in Germany, I can't help to see that as an initial attack on the German psyche. I mean, just look at how much they have pinned on the Germans from before the World War One to after World War II. And I'm just wondering if this is a long-standing battle against the German people that they've been trying to break them down. I mean, they tried with the Versailles Treaty of turning all of Germany basically into, you know, farmland for all the rest of Europe and blame everything on them. Then when that didn't work, they tried, you know, they basically did the same after the Second World War. And I think it was E. Michael Jones who mentioned on our show as well that when they divided Germany after the Second World War into the East and the West, one of the first thing that happened is they started to, turn like over focuses and emphasis on pornography in Western Germany, for example. So all of this is very much an attack on the psyche, as you say, Thomas.
Germany is the heart of Europe. It really is. And if you read books on German folklore history, like Lewis Benz's book on German folklore and folk tales, you just see how deep the German psyche is, how deep it goes back. We're talking about, you know, when people are given the term the German, they have this idea of this kind of efficient machine man, someone who works very hard, is very logical, very sensible, and does as he's told. But Germans were not like that. That's only a very recent modern invention. That all came out of the Prussian Empire when they invented, they came up with their education system. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, the Germans were very much like the Irish or the Scots. They were very much a more earthy kind of people, like the Irish and the Scots would have been back then. And I'm sure the Swedes and the Danes and everyone else were like that at one point as well.
Sure.
Before we were all altered at some point. Yeah. But they were very much like that. And they had this very deep connection to the forest and the mountains of their country, where the German psyche had developed in that sort of like hexan sort of primordial soup, very closely aligned to Nordic ideas and Nordic heritage, coupled with Teutonic. And they had this, they defeated the Romans so much to the point that, you know, every year up until, you know, the time of Bismarck, they used to go, Germans, thousands of Germans would go to areas in the forests where the Romans had been defeated by the Germans. The Germans were a deep, deep, deep people with a very intense psyche, and they were not an easy group to break down.
No.
And they were also very cultured and very, very, very relaxed and very open. They were very comfortable with the idea of all these kinds of ideas coming in and out. They're different. And remember, Germany was only united under Bismarck, and that's only when the rot started, kind of, really.
Yep.
But the problem with Germany was never the German people. It was the aristocratic class. It really was. If you look at the aristocrats of Germany, they have spawned so much damage in the world. They're the ones. It began with the German aristocrats attacking the German peasantry, attacking the German worker, the German, small business person. It comes out of Frankfurt. It comes out of like the Bavarian Illuminati. We know that was a bunch of German banks working for the royal families, which include the Rothschilds, specifically designed to actually cause cultural change, which they did when they infiltrated the Grand Orient Lodge in Paris. The real darkness of Germany is not the German people. It's the German aristocrats, and they're a very, very funny bunch. And they seem to be the royal family that has actually created all the other royal families. If you look at the British royal family, the Spanish royal family, the Dutch royal family, they all go back to Prussia, and they all go back to that the Teutonic Knights. This very kind of dark archetype that was inherent in German aristocratic society, that also, you know, supported both the Nazis and the Bolsheviks, by the way, after the Weimar Republic. But the target was always that the German people, okay, they're linguistically united, but they're not culturally united, and they're not suited to, you know, Prussian aristocratic ideals of what we need them to be. So starting with like measures on linguistics, when they actually had the first sort of like Germanic linguistic council to get rid of languages like Plattdeutsch. We can talk later on about German folk and European folklore, mm-hmm. and why it's important to look at this stuff. Yep. But they altered the language. They took away early German, Old Saxon, and they created a new language, a new version of German that was to solidify. And this was, you know, applicable from Austria all the way up to, you know, the North Sea. And the idea was to change the German speaker into a way. And you can see that the experimentation in Germany with like William II, they were very, very interested in getting at the Germans and changing them.
Yeah.
And when they did that, that was then expanded to the rest of the world. And to the point now where, and they're still messing with the Germans. The Germans are still being messed with to this day, like you said, when the wall came down. Well, nobody ever talks about we hear about the British royals, but we never hear about that the British royals are actually Germans. We never hear that. We always hear about like the British royals being the problem. We never hear that the real thing, there's still a huge base of aristocrats in Germany. And basically the model is this: the German aristocrats hire intellectuals, mostly Jewish, but not uniquely. They also hire Jesuits to alter German society according to everything from education to psychology, and then that becomes the control system to change Germans. And when Germans are successfully changed, then they move that to other countries. Hence why when Hitler was doing it with his bunch, the American and the British elites were absolutely enamored with the Nazis. They're saying, oh look, they've changed them again, how can we get a piece of this action? And it goes on and on. And people spent in this movement, because we're sort of like Anglo-centric or American-centric because of the English language, we tend to forget that psyops go on everywhere, and the biggest psyop of all was in Germany.
Yep, I believe you're right, and I think it's important to point out as well that this beyond or beneath this ideology, it's not something of a veneration for the nationalistic values. It's actually hatred and resentment for the people that I see that actually is driving this. It's a way of, obviously, this is actually a sample that the Romans used a lot. It's kind of like the Borg out of Star Trek or something like that. If you encounter someone who is strong and can resist you, the prime objective is to take them over and convert them, and then use them against everyone else. Use their strength against not only themselves but other people around that. And consequently, as we've seen, of course, you can put all the blame on them as well, which is very efficient. It's a way of using, a stronger person as a shield or what have you. This is a very long tactic. I think people are very myopic in their view of history, and they tend to focus in on one thing, that it's just one consequence. I mean, again, people forget that even the rise of, you know, Hitler and what happened under World War II and everything else is a response to something. It just doesn't come out of nowhere and just, oh my God, look at this, what are they doing? And all these Germans are falling for it and everything else. There was reason and logic behind it. They realized that their country is being completely overrun. They realized that they didn't have any monetary system. It's actually, you know, they tried to respond to this in a certain way. And I think that they've been horribly, horribly, used as a people for many different purposes to bring in, you know, what we see today, a new world order, basically, you know?
All you have to do is look at the events, which I cover in my new book, Walpurgis Night, Volume 1, that took place in Bavaria, in Munich, in 1919. What happened in that weekend around April 30th and May 1st is the story of the human race today. The Bolsheviks, on one hand, now remember, both sides are part of the manipulation. The aristocrats never get affected. They just sit back and pull the strings. But basically, they brought in Russian Bolsheviks into Munich. Yeah. And now let's talk about this. This is interesting stuff. This is to bring up now. They went in there with the intention of creating a Bavarian Soviet. Because of the chaos that was going on in the aftermath of the Versailles Treaty and the declaration of the Weimar Republic, and also the country being in bits because of World War One, the Bolsheviks snuck in. They could not have crossed those borders without royal consent. I'm sorry, they just couldn't have. Somebody somewhere at the top, in the actual elite in Germany, had brought these people in, these fanatics, that's the way I would describe them, into Bavaria and into Munich. And what happened was, there was this guy called Max Levine. He was the one who basically headed the Bavarian Soviet. As soon as it was declared, it was the typical Bolshevik thing. They basically turned it into a police state. More than anyone they want to, these armed Bolshevik Reds went all around the city, you know, killing anyone they felt like. They made statements that they were going to cut off the milk supply to the city because it was better that bourgeois children starve because that's what they deserve, yeah. And all this kind of thing. And in between, it was the average German, the average citizen of Munich, the average Bavarian, sitting there in a hell, wondering what happened, while all these creeps with Russian accents sitting there telling them that they've been liberated. These upper middle class types that had never been in a coal mine or in a factory in their lives, telling the people with Russian accents in Bavaria that you're now free. Now, as this was happening, there was a group called the Free Corps and the Tula Combat League who were descending on the city to smash the rebellion, to smash the Soviet. And they came in and they caused mayhem, but they quickly showed what cowards the cultural Marxists were. They were only heroes and they were vicious thugs as long as they were in power. As soon as somebody came in and said, oh you're not going to get away with that, they ran like chickens back to the Russian border as fast as they could, leaving their own people behind them to be brutally murdered by the Free Corps. So they go into Munich, they cause a mess, nothing works out, and then they run back to Russia. Now, in the meantime, the people of Bavaria, these are the ones who had the front row seat to history. They saw what the Bolsheviks were truly like. They saw what their agenda was all about. In came the Free Corps, and the Free Corps left an enormous psychological impression on the population. Now, I'm not saying the Free Corps are heroes or anything like that. Well, probably most of the Free Corps were actually regular soldiers, were just doing their duty and trying to save their country. But there was some very sinister individuals in there, like Rudolf Hess. But having said that, they went in and they took the Reds on one for one and immediately started feeding people as soon as it ended. Now, that left a deep, lasting impression in people in Germany because it showed them, it gave them a deep fear of the Soviets and the Bolsheviks because they saw that reign of terror in Munich that weekend. And it never left the Germans. And then people say, well, how could the Germans have such a hatred? And, you know, how could so many millions of German troops join the SS? Now, remember, the SS were a pretty nasty bunch. We cannot get away from that. They killed as many Poles, Catholics, you know, all kinds of, even French, British prisoners of war, as much as they did the Jews or Roma gypsies or anyone else. And they were a pretty nasty bunch. Having said that, the main thing that drove them to join the SS was a hatred of communism. And that hatred of communism directly happened because of the behavior of these Russian Bolsheviks in Munich on that weekend in 1919. And you cannot read a history book anywhere in the mainstream that talks about that was what caused the reaction and turned the German people. Yeah. You will never get it. You'll never get the truth. In fact, you can go to sites like Spartacus.com, which is a nauseating academic site by a bunch of college professors, most of them, of course, in Cambridge in England, raving about this guy, Levine, like he was a great hero. The guy was a murderous thug. And that's what the German, ordinary German people saw that stuff firsthand, up front, and suffered it. And that's why they reacted the way they did. They weren't morons who just marched, you know, gleefully into war because they saw a swastika. It wasn't that black and white.
No, it never is. It's the simplification of history and the, of course, consequent
writing of history of the victors is an extremely powerful weapon. And this particular area that we're in right now, there's just so many lies and so much garbage flying around that people unfortunately have been swallowing for many, many years since after World War II. So, I mean, all we can do is urge people to continue to look into this and continue to question and continue to look at everything and try to get a view from both sides here. But, I mean, you're absolutely right. What it ultimately is about, whether you know, we can sit and debate history of what actually happened, who was it, you know, all that stuff. We should do that, but we could sit endlessly and debate and talk about that. But what it ultimately, in my mind, boils down to is the need for people to have a Satan, for the lack of a better term, in their worldview, because it simplifies everything for them. It gets more comfortable, it gets more easy when you have a clear and distinct enemy of history, and this is just the way it is, and it causes you to fight endlessly. It causes you. It's kind of a religious programming, actually, when you think about it. It comes out of the same environment where you have the rise of the devil or something like that, and people are on a clear means of what is to do. This is who we have to, you know, fight and whatnot. So that's kind of what we can appeal to here, is try to look beyond the religious programming that goes on with people when it comes to the view of any history, really, and realize that there is always humans behind all of this. But see, when you do that, it becomes complex, it becomes too difficult for you, and so people tend to avoid that issue, right?
I'm glad you brought up the religious stuff. Max Weber, the German social theorist who was a big shot at the turn of the last century, 1800s to 1900s, he wrote on and social anthropology mainly, some very interesting stuff. But he said that, you said that people need a devil. True, but they also need a Christ. They also
exactly.
need a savior.
Yeah, of course.
And he said for a movement or a people in a modern democracy to be inspired, it had been called at that point a Freia Christus, which means a kind of a new Christ, a new Christ to lead the people, and that people in democracies were not necessarily interested in bread and butter issues such as the inflation or the unemployment rate. That's not what inspires a person to go and vote or follow a Pied Piper. In a political Pied Piper or social Pied Piper, they have to couple that with a Christian sense of salvation, of a Christ-like figure, a Christ archetype who's going to lead them to the promised land. And this would have to be for any democracy to have any kind of successful movement. And remember, Adolf Hitler was that, and he was the result of democracy, that they had to have that kind of archetype running the show. And we see that over and over again. JFK had that, Obama had that. They all have that. So many of them had that. Juan Perón in Argentina had that. Even Castro had that in Cuba. Mm, yeah. This idea of a Christ-like figure, and certainly Che Guevara had it, that mass-murdering banker. They
yep.
had it.
Yep.
And so these social theorists like Max Weber and these social anthropologists were very acutely aware that the monotheistic, Abrahamic, and I'm going to use a word here that's going to shock a lot of people, but tough shit, infection of European consciousness has given these kingly types, these aristocrats, these to give a mandate towards one God, one ruler, one law, one good guy and one bad guy. Mm-hmm. And this is what screws up Western and Europe, specifically Europe, Europeans were the first Native Americans before the Native Americans. People have to remember this. Our cultures were obliterated by Christianity a thousand years ago.
Yeah.
The Christian infiltration of Western Europe is no different than Manifest Destiny in the North Americas. We got done to us what the Native Americans got done to them. And it was the same force. It wasn't Europeans that went out there and attacked Native Americans. It was the same pathological virus, that infection from the Middle East that has no business here. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with Muslims, Christians, and the other groups from the Middle East. However, it may work fine for them there. I don't know. I have no desire to go there. It doesn't belong west of the Dardanelles. I just know that. And the more I study history and the more I look into things like European folklore, it becomes apparent to me that we Europeans are not how we should be. We are all been altered, and it all began with monotheism. We were much better off when we lived in a polytheistic society. It suited our European identity, a relationship with the seasonal cycles, a relationship with everything, family, you name it. It was all there, community. It was all there into a polytheistic identity. This was taken away and transferred into what initially was Zoroastrianism. That's where it really all began. But the idea of that there's a one true God, therefore there's one true devil. And this is why people in Europe and the West are always conditioned to look for that Freya Christus. They're always conditioned to look for this salvatory person who will save them. And at the same time, our control structure gives us a devil for us to hate. It's the same spell. And we have to break that Abrahamic monotheistic virus that's inside Western thinking. It doesn't belong here. It's not us. And I'm talking about Christianity as well, folks. Don't give me this thing that Jesus is Europe. He wasn't.
No.
It wasn't from there.
No.
And you know, be very, you know, I'm not saying stuff is bad or evil or wrong. I'm just saying it's not for us. And it seems to have damaged us. So sit back and look at what, and I'm not saying anyone should be coming out and start dressing like Vikings or anything like that. I'm just saying,
nah, you can do that. That's good. No,
yeah, it's pretty cool. No problem with that. But, you know, I mean, my attitude is every man should carry a sword and every woman too.
Yep.
But let's start, instead of them reconstructing us, how about we start deconstructing ourselves? And the first one is to say, look, maybe we don't need the Bible. Maybe this Bible stuff, this stuff that came over here, was a really bad news, because all you have to do is look at the first ones to embrace it were like the likes of Charlemagne, and he was a, you know, his cruelty against the pagan Saxons was is shocking to even read it today.
Yeah.
You know, and he says, convert to Christianity or else.
Yeah.
That was the end of it. Convert to Christianity or else. Now, there's only one reason why he wanted that, because he understood that there was a pathological, psychopathic power structure in the Abrahamic idea. The Council of Nicaea was actually our manifest destiny. That's really what it was. That was the blueprint for the destruction of the European consciousness. They didn't call it that, but that's really what it became. And that was the whole, it gave us the Roman Empire and all this other, and all the Vatican, the idea of absolute rule of kings, the divine rule of kings. That did not exist in earlier times. Kings in Nordic, Celtic, Gaelic, Germanic, Teutonic, Anglo-Saxon, kings were not this separate god away from the people. They were actually lived with them.
Yeah.
They were, you know, they were sort of like almost like Gandalf and Lord of the Rings. They were more like that. But these were a guy who could actually pick up a sword and stand on the front line with the peasants and go to war with them. Many of the kings of ancient of Europe before monotheism were often killed in battle alongside their men. They weren't on horses in the back when you had the monotheistic king came in. Suddenly, they were too close to God to actually fight. It gave these elites and these royals very good power and a very good kind of psyop to play on the people. And you see that reflected in things like Al Gore, right? Al Gore, Vice President of the United States, the king of climate change. And you can point at the fact that he's a spectacular hypocrite. A spectacular hypocrite, right? He lives in a palace. This is what his fuel bill is. And people that this day will say, ah, yes, but he's important. He's important. And that comes directly out of this kind of idea of this monotheism that came here. Yeah. I'm not offending Christians. I'm not offending Muslims or Jews. Anyone else in the Middle East, God bless you. Good luck to you. You just, in a social sense, your stuff doesn't work here. It's as simple as that. And that's the end of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree there. I mean, we've developed for thousands of years outside of this kind of archetypal structure that has been superimposed with violence and enforcement upon us. And it has split us up and fractured us, not only as a people, but even inside in our psyche, you know. And it is a Semitic tradition. And the fact is we have, you know, a Germanic, Nordic, you know, native European tradition that have been in existence for many, many thousands of years. And again, you can't just take one thing, supplant it above another, and expect nothing to, you know, no consequence or nothing to happen from there. So that's a really important point. And there's much more to this, Thomas, that we need to talk more about in the second segment as we continue and carry on here. But before we take a little break here, let's talk just a little bit about your website, where people can find your stuff, of course. I mentioned your titles and the new one you had out, Valpurgis Night. I think it's the first volume out now, right?
Yes, it's basically, I got so tired of reading history books, particularly anything to do with like the treatment of Germans during National Socialism and even after World War One, and even during World War One, that wasn't a polemic by some idiotic academic who was just like couldn't get through two paragraphs without, you know, implying how evil or stupid the Germans were.
Oh, yeah.
So I decided to, and then Europeans as a whole, except for, you know, Churchill and all those types. So I've decided like to write Valpurgis Night Volume 1, and there'll be two others, but I may even develop into more because the reception to Valpurgis Night Volume 1 has been phenomenal. So people have just been telling me it's like it is the way history should be taught. And I specifically wrote the book in such a way that it would be like a saga. It was telling the story of what happened in Central Europe between 1919 and 1933 in the style as if we were sitting around the campfire and I was relaying the story in the way of a saga, in the way without any kind of overt political or other chip on my shoulder. This is what happened. This is and how it happened. And I bring in different ideas of how monotheism and the idea of the Book of Leviticus may have, and it's a influence on Bolsheviks and so on. And it's how I would want to hear history. So mainly because of the 100th anniversary of World War One, which was the flip over point, and all this nauseating ceremonies they're going to have to celebrate all the millions who were died, mm-hmm. and they'd have all the royals from Europe standing around laying wreaths, even though they were the ones who killed all these people. I wanted to sort of write history in the way it used to be told, the way our European ancestors told history, as a saga, as a story, easily conveyed, and then bring in the ideas of like, I think, you know, all the great sagas talk about history, but they also talk about the occult and the supernatural aspects. And we all know that in Germany at that time, there was an enormous amount of occult organizations, from the Thulas to the Order of the Templars, and the Thule Society, sorry, and the Orders of the Templars. And I brought all that in the same idea, in order to make it interesting, because I read so many history books in the last 2 years when researching for this that I see now that history itself was the greatest psyop of all. Yeah. They make it cold, yeah, and they make it a polemic. And what I do is I'm just making it into a saga. So that book is called Valpurgis Night, and you can get that through thomassheridanarts.com. And all my other books like Animal of the Psyche, which deals with social engineering, are on there as well. And the journey has taken a great turn for me. It actually happened by visiting an SS bunker in Norway, believe it or not. I was actually over there in Norway speaking.
Cool.
And I was taken to an SS bunker in a mountain in Sola. And I went down in there and I just tried to, and something hit me. And I said, what led to this? What led to German men, young men, you know, in there, in that hole in the ground? What led to that? And it was one of these kind of almost sort of like, I won't say mythic, but I went into this bunker in pitch blackness with my friend, and I came out of it. And when I came out of it, it was almost like, you know, standing atop of this fjord in Norway. And I was like, you know, somebody has to say something. And so I just, that was where the idea came from. That.
Well, that's great, Thomas. I mean, thank you for just having an interest in this, because I think it's so important. I think one of the other things as well is that people don't understand that kind of domino effect that has consequently occurred since the takeover of Germany, the heart of Europe, as you said, and consequently all the other countries, and how history has one event has you know, nudged the other, and we've had this whole cascade effect of things occurring, and so much hinging on this particular history as well. And if it turns out that a lot of what we've been taught when it comes to history, it is false. This whole, you know, domino is shaken to the core. What does it mean? What happens if we have been lied to about certain things? How does that change our history? How does that change who we are today? I mean, this is tremendously important in our times. So it's excellent that you've decided to try to you know, write about this and you know, approach this subject and also, you know, kind of try to deconstruct some of it as well. Okay, the website here then, thomassheridanarts.com. Please head on over there, check out the books from there. You have everything on the menu there. And we're going to continue, Thomas, and talk more about this, of course. I have many more questions for you. This is just a great conversation. So we'll pick this up shortly. Stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Thomas. We'll be right back with more.